Thank you very much. Port Arthur, the community especially that Hilton lives in, works in, not the the people that live there do not work in the industry. They get the effluent from the industry. They don't get the payoff. And the people who actually work there, they know that their 8-hour occupational exposure is enough. And they live somewhere else, and they drive in every day. So I can really relate to that situation with Hilton. And I remember, you know, when the EPA was first instituted, and the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act came about, even though it was Richard Nixon, of all people, who did this. Nonetheless, it was quite a thing. And to live with before that, because there aren't too many people around who remember that at this point, but to live before that and then see the changes afterward, those acts have done so much good for our environment and our you know, collective health, that I can't imagine how anybody could ever say regulations are a bad thing. But I live in Texas, and I hear that all the time. Anyway, here's a picture of the channel coming in and out of Point of Chien, Louisiana. The reason why I'm here really is because I've worked for the last 3 years in a project that one of the U19 consortium projects, the NIEHS funded, to look at the impacts of the Gulf oil. We call it well blowout, the Deepwater Horizon well blowout, because it was the well exploded. And if you look at this channel, you can see all these ghostly looking trees. And the people there call them ghost oaks. The reason why they're ghostly is because the salinity has changed and there's too much saline water now, heavily, you know, salty water, and the oaks can't live in that kind of environment. But they didn't used to be that way, nor did that channel used to be so wide. This is something that's happening because of man's impact on the marsh, and also climate change is accelerating it. Okay, I have to say this. Okay, I have no disclosures. I have no stock in any company that's doing this. And fishing economy, since I've been working with fishermen, my job in the project we have been doing on the Gulf Coast is to go with the fishermen and do sampling. And we have been sampling from the food web for the last 3 years. And I've been out on shrimp boats and oyster barges and crab boats, and then gone fishing with people. It sounds like a lot of fun, and actually it has been very enjoyable and rewarding. But I've learned a lot about the fishing communities and the fishing economies in the process. Some of it is sad. Some of it, though, is actually, you know, a courageous story. Anyway, these economies come in different sizes. We've mostly been working with the subsistence and small-scale commercial, not so much with the commercial and industrial freezer boats that will go out for 8 weeks and, you know, get a whole lot of shrimp or a whole lot of whatever, they're mostly shrimp, and bring it back in and then, you know, have a week off and go back out again. The guys we've been working with, mostly guys, not all guys though, there are women that do this too. You all know Diane Wilson, probably you've heard of her. She's a friend of mine and fourth generation shrimper, and she's not unique. There are a number of women who do this. They're, you know, very different from, you know, the guys that do it. They have a different approach to it, different attitude toward it. They're probably a little bit more environmentally inclined too. But I just wanted to mention that. But the scale and resilience of communities seems to be connected. The scale of the economy and the resilience factor seems to be connected, but it's a very complicated connection. Not necessarily would the subsistence people be the most affected, the least able to bounce back, the less resilient. They might be more resilient than the people in the middle, who seem to be the most affected because they borrow money to fix their boats. They try and upgrade equipment, and all of this takes cash. And if their cash flow is interrupted, even for one fishing season, they're really in a world of hurt. And the subsistence people, because they're subsistence, are able to really roll with the punches pretty well. The big people, they can always deal with it. It seems to be that way. I'm looking at this through the lens of cumulative risk, all the different risk factors that a community might be exposed to. And you put all that together, and Wilma Subra described this as a bad-tasting layer cake. You have these layers of socioeconomic problems you're dealing with, layers of healthcare access you're dealing with, layers of the oil problems you're dealing with, layers of climate change you're dealing with, and your community is subjected to this all at once. And they're all interrelated. And I have something I wrote here about it: vulnerability factors such as susceptibility, differential exposure, differential preparedness, can affect your ability to recover from hazardous exposures or plan for and adapt to things that might happen additionally in the future. And these are some of the components of cumulative risk that we've discovered in the process of working with the fishing communities. And all of them are things you've probably heard, because you know the Gulf, people talk about this in the Gulf, the land loss, the subsidence, the erosion, and the sea level rise, and the effects that's had. But there are other things too, like fishing and the energy industry are inextricably related by proximity, and a lot of the people that fish also work on rigs, also work as transporters, taking people out to rigs or equipment out. So it's not so easy to pry them apart. The effects of drought on the viability of the fisheries. Now there's a climate change factor right there. The droughts have been actually pretty severe. You wouldn't know it, but it's affecting the fresh water coming into the estuaries, which affects the viability of the estuary in terms of the fishery. The effects of temperature and salinity changes, and I just talked about that. The intense competition from non-U.S. seafood industry products is really wiping people out. The generational shifts in employment trends, the community housing, health, and employment issues. And then this last one, efforts to control greenhouse gases emissions in political disarray. And we all should look at graphs like this constantly and think about what it means. But this is a concentration pathway that diverges. The blue one that looks better is what will happen if we do something about this, something that has been proposed by the intergovernmental panel. And the red one is what might happen if business as usual prevails. And it's not good. And the temperature rise of, you know, getting up into 6 rather than up into 2.5 or 1.5 when it eventually levels off, the difference is tremendous. This is a map of coastal Louisiana and what's happened to it lately. Look at the red, orange, burnt umber part. These are the parts that are either going away or have gone away. Now, this next one is an animation of the same thing. Here's 1839, not that long after the Louisiana Purchase. 1870, 1993, 2020, if nothing happens. I mean, this is a business as usual kind of format. This is not good. And here are the distributions of petrochemical exploration and production sites. These are refineries, they're oil wells, and this is where they are in the Gulf. The ones that are in the water, of course, are offshore rigs. Some of them are not active anymore, but there are that many of them. Just because a rig is not active doesn't mean it's not leaking, because many of them are never maintained after they're abandoned, or at least not very well. But look at that as a wealth of potential exposure pathways if there were to be a big storm, or even just a leak, a constant, small, steady leak. And these are the channels that have been cut into the marsh, and mostly by industry and mostly by the energy industry, because this is easy access out to their exploration site or their production site, and they can send a barge out to bring back the product. But it's really not good for the marsh and the salinity changes. Once the salinity changes, the marsh grass, the Spartina grass, will start to die. And then when it gets hit by a big storm, it just gets washed away. Now, if that weren't happening, it could actually be a hurricane dampener, which is what it always had been traditionally. This is Delacroix, and it's just an example. I just picked this picture out because this little strip of land you see there with some buildings on it is all that's left of this town that used to be 700 people. Now, it was always a small place, but there was a lot more land, a lot more marsh. It supported the traditional Louisiana bayou lifestyle of fishing, hunting, and trapping. And these were people who were very self-sufficient, but very few people live there now. This is the Louisiana master plan to do something about the coastline, about erosion, subsidence, and salinity changes and all that. And you can see that there are sediment diversions happening, ridge restorations, barrier island and headland restorations, and shoreline protection, marsh creation. This is all good, but it has to be done very quickly. And we're always wondering when will be the next Hurricane Katrina, because this isn't going to change. This area is prone to that anyway, and because of climate change, these storms are getting stronger. And this is a micro level of the same thing, just to look at what's being done in, okay, over here in Plaquemines Parish, around Port Sulphur, the Barataria Bay area. This is a sediment diversion, the sediment that used to go into the land restoration every year from the Mississippi River, which is, okay, time to move, all right. I just want to say one thing here about the one in the right-hand corner. The purple is where they're going to put in reinforcement of the levees. Look at the communities that are not in that anymore. They are just left to their own devices. Ile de Jean Charles, Leeville, Cocodrie, and then Golden Meadow, it's in it, but I mean it's right on the edge of it. And levees don't necessarily mean full protection anyway, of course. Okay, once again, here's a nice picture of the coexistence of two inimical things. They really don't belong together, fishing and energy production, but they're there together. And oyster spat it ends with. I want to talk a little bit about oyster reefs. This is the Cedar Point Reef in Alabama. It's been closed for a number of years. They opened it, and it's open for a couple of weeks now every year. We've been actually taking samples from it. But the droughts in Alabama and Mississippi have really affected the oyster productivity. The freshwater flush that the state government here did after the Deepwater Horizon blowout also affected the salinity in Plaquemines Parish and really wiped out the oyster industry in that area on the east side. And the oyster drill, an invasive species, climate change is part of that too. Here are some of the unfair competition factors from overseas seafood industry. Now the WTO has something to do with this. You aren't allowed to, you know, protective tariffs can't be levied against stuff that's coming in from a foreign country because it's cheaper, and we really don't have the same environmental regulatory authority over countries that are doing things in a way different way than our fishermen have to do it. And I just mentioned Thailand and Malaysia because our State Department downgraded them this year because of the human trafficking in the seafood industry that's happening there. Now, you know, we don't have that here. And the fishermen here have to deal with the labor cost of the negligible labor cost there as opposed to the labor cost here. Add to that the fuel cost. This is a very difficult industry to make a living in anymore. And these are the reasons why. And these are anecdotal. We don't have a survey we've done with the fishermen. They don't like to do surveys. I talked to them about this. And these are things that are commonly shared problems that they talked about. But the one that really is a bummer is, you see in this picture, this guy with the red hat who's looking out to the sea, that's the dad. The guy with his hand on the winch control is the son. The son, of course, would like to be doing this for a living, but he's actually a welder at Port Fouchon because this is where he can get employment that isn't seasonal, that isn't unpredictable, and he'd rather be fishing, but he can't. And this is the last thing. And these are just some of the other factors that are happening in the area. This is a picture of a lady being kicked out of her house in Safe Harbor in Bayou La Batre, which was a Katrina, after Katrina, HUD money built this housing development for people who had no housing anymore. And now they've decided it's going to become a more or less for-profit thing, and people that can't pay the increasingly rising rents are evicted. And this has been a real issue The federal government's been involved in it. One of the people involved in it was actually convicted of fraud and did some time. It was a mayor by a Labatry, actually. And these are the take-home messages. I'm going to read them to you because I sometimes I don't even believe this, but I hope. The Gulf fishermen and their communities are resourceful and have demonstrated their resilience time and again. Cumulative risk burdens are significant but not insurmountable challenges if we actually work on them. And policy to strengthen community resilience should be comprehensive, coordinated, and cognizant of cumulative risk, or it ain't going to work. The cumulative risk part is what's going to make it not work. If you don't do that, if you don't know that you're addressing all this stuff at once, it won't work. And acknowledgments to all the guys and women whose boats I went out on, and what I learned, and the people I worked for. Wilma Subra, who is the trusted scientific messenger throughout the Gulf, and Mary Lee Orr, who is the director of the Louisiana Environmental Action Network, who helped with this a lot. Thank you.
Great. So we'll hold questions to the end now, just so we have a chance to have Rob Vercheck finish. It actually is quite fitting that Rob is wrapping up the panel in terms of, you heard policy and litigation and law run throughout all the presentations prior to his. So Rob actually holds the Gauthier St. Martin Chair in Environmental Law at Loyola University, New Orleans, where he's the faculty director of the Center for Environmental Law. He is also a senior fellow in disaster resilience leadership at Tulane University and a member scholar of the Center for Progressive Reform, a national policy institute focused on public health and environmental protection. Professor Vercheck recently served in the Obama administration as the Deputy Associate Administrator for Policy at the U.S. EPA. In that role, he helped develop climate change adaptation policy for the EPA and served on President Obama's interagency climate change adaptation task force. In the fall of 2012, he researched climate adaptation policies in India as a visiting scholar at the Center for Policy Research in New Delhi, supported by a Fulbright Award. You can also find his books, but I'm going to let him get started. Yeah. So, Rob, go ahead.
Well, you can see we have our problems down here for sure, but one of the things that we have are tremendously committed, smart, resourceful people working down here in the Gulf, and they have shared some of their views and ideas with you as well. We are doubly, triply blessed with the kind of talent that we have down here, homegrown and people who've come in to be our friends and make this place their home, because it's a really special place. Now, one of the themes of this conference, I gather, just from looking at a lot of the information, has to do with resilience, right? And you know, in the public health sector, one way of looking at resilience is a function, if you will, of exposure or pathways of hazard, and then susceptibility or vulnerability on the part of whoever's being exposed to that. And we've been talking about that all morning, actually, if you think about that. We've looked at both physical hazards that expose people to danger, which might be chemicals or it might be storms, for instance. And then we've seen these special vulnerabilities that people have. And maybe they're hungry too, who knows? But vulnerabilities of people who do not have good health care, who may not have good diets, or may not have all kinds of support networks that other folks might have. Now, there have been people who've tried to put these two things together in some kind of map or way of understanding on a broad scale. Susan Cutter is one of these people. She's a geography from South Carolina, a geographer from South Carolina. And she has pointed out that you can index both physical vulnerability and you can index what I'll call social vulnerability, okay, based on income, race, healthcare, education, all of these kinds of things. Now, there are a lot of things in the South and the Gulf region that set us apart. And one of them is the physical vulnerabilities down here. And we make a lot about that. And we've got a whole history of music and art and novels that sort of talk about the physical vulnerabilities down here from storms and so on. And we are unusual in that way compared to other parts of the country. But we are more unusual in terms of our social vulnerability here. Our index is higher, is another way to say it. And that means what makes us most special down here is the social vulnerability, not the physical exposures. And that's important, because if you could fix one thing down here, whether it's building a seawall or making sure people have good health care, you might pick the good health care. And the other thing to understand is that a lot of our special vulnerabilities in terms of physical vulnerabilities are vulnerabilities that are also shared in many other parts of the country, including, as we know, New York and New Jersey and that area, the entire eastern seaboard, and also parts of California as well when you look at earthquakes and these other things. So it's very hard to find any place on the map, I'll guarantee you. I mean, I study this for a living, that doesn't expose itself to some kind of natural disaster. And so that's just one thing, I think, to think about. What I really want to point out in the remaining time that I have is I want to make a case for a special kind of infrastructure that you might not have thought about very much before perhaps you arrived here. And it's an infrastructure that is absolutely essential to public health and well-being down here in the Gulf, particularly in southern Louisiana. And that infrastructure is the Louisiana coastal wetlands, the largest coastal wetlands in the United States. It is, as you've already seen, a storm barrier for many people down here. It is a supply for food. 20 to 25% of all the seafood eaten in the United States, protein, right, from the sea, comes from areas that are nursed by these wetlands. And these wetlands actually protect the oil and gas industry infrastructure down here, too, which I will point out keeps the lights running from natural gas and electricity. You don't have sewage treatment plants running. You don't have drinking water plants running. You don't have hospitals running if you have an interruption in that energy line. I saw that in India all the time. I'm a fan of electricity. So those are the kinds of things that we need to keep in mind. But this story is sort of good, bad, and ugly. All right, and in the remaining time, I'm just going to give you a snapshot of each of those, and then we can talk about them jointly, maybe, if people are interested. Well, we know why these wetlands are going away, and it's a football field, a half an hour, an hour, whatever you want to call it. We've lost 1,800 square miles of land in 80 years. It's because of the channelization of the Mississippi. It's because of the oil and gas industry, which you've seen what they've done, and it's also because of sea level rise due to climate change. The good news is we have this wonderful protection. I keep pointing up here because John had these lovely slides, but he had the lovely slides of the Coastal Protection Master Plan, which is very good, based on extremely good science. It's a 50-year project if you were to do the whole thing. $50 billion and counting is probably what it would cost over that time. And you could spot well the Gulf Coast in a way that would, after about 60 years, create more land than is actually being lost. It's based on very good climate science, the best climate science available in the world, looking at stream flows from the Mississippi, looking at sea level rise, looking at precipitation patterns down here. I emphasize this because if you were to pull this up online, you would see one name on the front cover, and that's Governor Bobby Jindal, who knows about everything that's in there, including all of the science and including the forecasts about carbon emissions over the next 50 years. And yet this is a man on television who suggests climate change doesn't exist. All right? So we've got a political thing going on here, and I've seen this in a number of so-called red states, where governors who won't claim that climate change exists quietly allow their agencies to use all the climate information that the other agencies provide, including the EPA, because somewhere they know, right? The bad news in this is that our government, and here I'm going to take the Obama administration to task, is not doing enough to protect coasts like ours from this oil and gas infrastructure. Now, we know about the BP blowout, and you've probably heard lots of things about really the cravenness involved in BP. This is stuff that's public record now, how they pressured workers to put profits over safety, how they deliberately neglected to put certain kinds of preventers and other mechanical infrastructure into their rigs. But what you might not know is the federal government shares huge amounts of blame in this. We still have laws that have no technology standards for safety devices on rigs, including those blowout preventers and things like that. No technology-based standards in any of that. We have laws that actually discourage environmental review. If you can't do the environmental review in 90 days, it's presumed the permit is granted. All right. These are things that are written into the laws. On top of that, the people who manage this whole area in the Department of Interior have not had raises, their staffs have been cut, and their budgets either remain the same or they remain cut. So if you wonder why they don't have as much expertise or knowledge about the oil industry as BP, there's absolutely a reason for that. There's a reason, because we have hollowed out government. All right. That's the bad. The ugly part, which I will just quickly mention, has to do with the fact, which is very unusual to explain unless you look at politics, of the fact that despite the fact that we have a coastal restoration program that could work but that needs $50 billion, we still have a policy for insisting that only the taxpayers are the ones held responsible. So there is a levy board that has independence because of a Louisiana amendment to its constitution, which is in charge of health and public safety in New Orleans Parish and two adjoining parishes. It is harder for it to do its job because of the evaporating wetlands. So it sued 97 oil and gas companies using evidence showing that between 25 and 50% of all the damage can be attributed to the oil and gas industry. And most of that, they claim, is a result of illegal activity, violations of permits, environmental laws, and so on. All they were asking was money so that they could help protect the public health and the public welfare. The governor and the governor's office suggested it was a frivolous lawsuit. They took it to court, and the judge said, no, it's not a frivolous lawsuit. It will go forward. The next thing that happened was last spring, the Louisiana legislature passed a law specifically forbidding state agencies or municipalities from bringing lawsuits over natural erosion or over erosion having to do with the oil and gas industry. I and 100 other law professors argued that was so broad that it could actually keep municipalities from maintaining their claims against BP. But even so, the law went forward, and it's now law. And a court has just recently said that they wrote it the wrong way because they didn't include levy boards, and so they say it doesn't apply to levy boards. So the lawsuit now is going forward, and the legislature opens again in the spring, and guess what one of the first orders of business is to rewrite that law to make sure that only the taxpayers of Louisiana and the United States pay for the destruction of that infrastructure. So something to think about is the ugly side, but there's a good side too. Infrastructure by its nature is underinvested in and overused. That's what happens to public goods. And that's why we need law and government to maintain those things for us. Thanks very much.